This episode is brought to you by Thorn, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorn is now offering you an ongoing 35% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorn is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorn.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorn. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorn, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show law enforcement officer turned mental health therapist, Don Bradley. So in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from Don's journey into law enforcement, some of his career calls, his own powerful mental health story, his transition out, becoming part of the proactive solution as a mental health therapist, the first responder marriage, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment, go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of almost 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Don Bradley. Enjoy. Well, Don, I want to start by saying thank you so much for taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
I'm currently sitting in a small town called Discovery Bay, California, which is East Bay of Northern California, the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area.
Well, I would have to start at the very beginning. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
Well, so I was born in Oregon, Salem, Oregon. And then I was born a twin. So for about 4 minutes, my mom got to think, oh, everything's going to be okay. And then this thing came out of there and made her limp for the next 5 years. We had five kids in the house at the time. Parents got divorced. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. My dad worked for Silver Stream back in the Silver Stream RVs, back those really silver ones.
Shiny ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then about 5 years old, we were taking a surprise vacation that was apparently only surprised to my dad. We ended up moving out to Oklahoma, the buckle of the Bible Belt. And, come to find out that that divorce thing had been sort of steaming for quite some time. Mom was a single mom that really struggled. We were, you know, as poor could be starting out. Then stayed in Oklahoma for the majority all the way up till college, right? Just getting sort of steeped in that, emotions or weakness, men don't cry type of mentality, right? And so, but for the most part, didn't realize how poor I was until we finally kind of got out of there and got a little perspective on it. But had very little contact with my dad because my mom hated him so much. And ultimately, the relationship with the dad was strained for the longest time. And, you know, my mom was my best friend. And then unfortunately, she passed about 20 years ago. And I got to sit front row seat to that. So.
Well, firstly, I'm sorry about your mom.
It was just one of those things where, you know, that was probably one of the main things that sort of spurred me to kind of do this sort of inside out process, because I had such a hard time understanding why I had to be the one that was there, right? And so resented, you know, everybody else that wasn't. And my sister and my stepfather eventually came in and unfortunately it was in the bedroom I grew up in high school. So it was like drilled way deep down. So unfortunately you got to go way deep down to unscrew that. So.
Well, before we even get to there, this is an aha moment that I had after, you know, several interviews by this point, probably in, I think, the first year. But Jake Clark and some other people really opened my eyes to the impact of our early life on, you know, our own mental health when we put the uniform on. And, you know, as I say a lot recently, if you are able to offload that or process some of those struggles when you're young, then, you know, you're extremely fortunate and you have that kind of more resilience going in. But I think a lot of people, it's buried down. You know, there's a Mexican proverb that says, they tried to bury us, they didn't know that we were seeds. And I love that. So, you know, forcing that down when we were little. So when you look back now, you've talked about divorce, obviously later on you talk about losing your mother, but through a young child's eyes, that little boy inside, what were some of the kind of the negative impacts of that? Even though, as people always say, you know, the parents did the best of what they had, what would be some of the kind of traumas you think through your eyes back then?
Well, not having a lot of the normal, just day-to-day life mentorship that you need to sort of live life, right? You know, how to deal with things emotionally. When the people who are raising you don't have the emotional tools for themselves, and they can't pass it on to you, right? And so trying to figure out how to deal with things are done from the outside in, right? You look at other people and see what you think is going to be there. You know, you look at them and sort of judge based on your broken system how they're doing it right based on what you see. And if your meter's broken, then you're going to just do it based because it's like, well, they look okay, so I'm going to do that. And it's sort of, it doesn't necessarily dig into that inside out process that you end up having to do.
What about sports and exercise? What were you doing as a kid through the school ages?
That was, well, so in Oklahoma, football's a big deal, right? And so football, sports were the way that you sort of, you know, it was a status, and it was you didn't realize that it was in fact an outlet, but it was definitely a status, right? If you played football, that's what everybody did. So you were supposed to do it, right? Excuse me. And so I did obviously football, played football. I did powerlifting and different things like that. But I was more the individual. I like to be more of the individual sports as opposed to the group stuff.
What about career aspirations? What were you dreaming of becoming through school age? Was it law enforcement, or was there something else first?
It wasn't. You know, what's funny is I found out pretty early that I was a old soul, which basically meant that I knew how to talk to adults, or I feel like I was aligned with an adult mentality. And what I realized pretty early is, you know, I think it was, in fact, I can vaguely remember a time when somebody told me, he's like, you should be a psychologist, because I was a really good listener for the most part. And what I gleaned from that, with no other sort of guidance in that way, was that I just wanted to help people, right? I just wanted to help people. That was it. It was a plain and simple, very Rube-like mentality. And so I didn't really necessarily, it wasn't like some, there was a history of law enforcement or there was a or any particular influence that said, you should do this. It was just sort of like, because there wasn't even that guidance. And so not having, I mean, I had a stepfather who was a fantastic man, but it wasn't like he was stepping in there and go, here's what you should do. And you should do this. I mean, I got the impression that he was sort of kind of staying back and not necessarily, he helped us. He supported us obviously financially, but he had had kids with a previous marriage. And I felt like he was just kind of staying back to make sure he didn't, you know, like he'd try to be overbearing or anything like that. Like I said, really fantastic guy. But it wasn't like he had this agenda to go, here's, I'm going to help you develop in life and become this person. So we were kind of freelancing it, looking around going, who's successful? What do we do? And the only reason that we even got out of, or at least for me, the only reason that I got out of that particular area was because of the divorce and how my dad lived on the West Coast. And so we'd get that exposure because a lot of the people that I knew that grew up in that area stayed in that area, which I didn't necessarily understand because I realized that the world was a much bigger place because of the exposure that I had. And so I just knew that I wanted more, but I didn't know exactly what I wanted.
A lot of people that have challenges when they're younger, especially if a parent is not there either physically or at least, you know, mentally, depending on the dynamic, is more often than not, if they find themselves ultimately on a good path, there were some mentors. It sounded like your stepdad was a good person. When you look back now, were there other, you know, men or women through this journey that also helped kind of steer you onto the right path?
Well, there were some influential teachers that were involved. One of my science teacher, some of my coaches and things like that. They were just positive influences, not so much people that basically said, go this direction or go this direction or find out who you are or anything like that. They just weren't, there's a positive influence and then there's a not negative influence, meaning somebody that was there didn't necessarily, weren't there to sort of negatively impact you. There were positive people who wanted to make sure that they sort of did right by you, but it wasn't like they said, here's the path you take, step one, step two, step three. It was, you know, and so once I got out of high school, I did pretty well in the school it was there, but they didn't necessarily prepare me for what it was going to be like to be in college, you know, like what, you know, time management, financial management, stuff like that. And so getting into that was like, the world became a much bigger place when I realized that I was the one that had to grab a hold of the steering wheel. So
what did that look like then? You graduate high school, you know, what was that path ultimately into law enforcement?
Well, so I graduated in a class of 48 people, right? And so not a massive amount of folks. And at the top of that, I think I graduated third in the class, which was great. It made me feel smart, but I wasn't, what I realized is when I finally got out there that I wasn't as smart as I thought I was. And so getting into college, I struggled quite a bit. And it was because I didn't know how about time management and knowing when to study and didn't have somebody on there saying, you got to study this. And in high school, I didn't really have to study. It was really super easy up to that point. And so when I finally got to the point where they demanded more of me, I was like, oh no, what do I do now? And not really. And it wasn't even like somebody was there to say, you should get a tutor and you should do this. And It was, you know, I struggled all the way through college and had various events that sort of affected the direction I was going, some injuries and stuff like that that definitely sent me off in a different direction.
What was the initial direction that you were trying to get to?
Well, my initial direction was to graduate with a degree in psychology but the thing is, I didn't know what I was going to do with it afterwards. All I knew is, I remember there was one class towards the end where I was like, where I thought to myself, God, I don't want to sit and listen to people's problems all day. That sucks. I wanted to actually get in the action, right? I wanted to, when I finally started to put it together, it was, I wanted to help people and I didn't want to die in a cubicle. And so that was very vague. There was a lot of different open-ended kind of searching that went on in that way. And again, like I said, it wasn't from the inside out. It was just sort of like, who's being successful and how can I, and look at them as the template and go in that direction based on what I see rather than what I know.
So talk to me about law enforcement being that direction that you were pulled towards.
Well, you know, when I finally came out to California, it was after this, I really didn't have a direction. I was kind of struggling because I needed a job. I needed to be able to make money, had no idea what I was doing. And then I had that epiphany of sort of going, well, I want to help people and I want to do that. Don't want to die in a cubicle. So at first I wanted to be a firefighter, but I didn't. There was too many people trying to do that, and not enough people trying to do law enforcement. So I thought, law enforcement sounds good. Let's do that. It was very seat of my pants type of way, you know, direction. And I kind of went in that direction because I just wanted, like I said, I wanted to actually be able to help. I wanted to be the hero. What we all kind of come from. I wanted to be that hero that, you know, ran into the building and saved folks.
It's funny because we're in the middle of a recruitment crisis now, and it's you know, something I think people have almost forgotten, that I have only been on, I would have been on 20 years had I stayed in uniform. So it's only 20 years ago that I first joined, and it was so competitive back then. If you go back even further, you know, it was even worse for a while. And now you look at today, you know, and this is what's sad, is there should be that same demand. The job is the same, you know, the actual, you know, profession itself, but the way that some of the working environments and some of the lack of support have devolved for our first responders. Now, you know, the recruitment crisis literally illustrates, you know, the lack of demand because people can see it for what it is. And it's an incredible calling, but there are some things that need to be fixed.
Without question. One of the main things that I see in a lot of the first responder clients that I have now is it used to be sort of an us versus them type of thing. You always had that home base to come back to. But being in California, especially, which is, you know, kind of the behind enemy lines for the most part, there's a lot that the support from the administration has disintegrated a lot, and I'm seeing a lot of folks come in, you know, wonder, you know, because it's a difficult job enough without wondering whether you're going to have to plug back into home base and whether somebody's coming at you from there too. So,
I had Sebastian Junger on several times, and his book Tribe, I think, is a, you know, absolute must read for everyone. But if you think about it from a law enforcement or fire perspective, you literally have sworn a kind of unspoken oath that you will die for the man or woman to the left, you know, and right of you, and obviously for the people that you're trying to respond to. The only reason that works is because you have that tribe. And you think about like an ancient civilization, you know, it takes a village and all these phrases, that tribe is everything. But the number of people I've had, especially in law enforcement, who have been, you know, wounded in line of duty and then cast aside. They were wearing the uniform when it happened. It was on an actual call. And then a year later, they're discarded, you know, the disposable heroes. So I think that the organizational betrayal, organizational stress element of the first responder, you know, mental health, addiction, suicide conversation is woefully under discussed.
It's very pervasive now, that sense of that disintegration that's coming from that, from the home base. That is definitely a theme that I'm starting to see. And what I think one of the main things that I've also seen is that we sign up for the idea of that being an eventuality, of having to involve ourselves and put our lives on the line in that way, but not really knowing what that meant, not really understanding, because you see a lot of people who have those moments and have those times where they thought they were going to die and then didn't. And then I'll see somebody that's had that experience. And what I realize is you signed up for what you thought, but you had no idea. You can't know what you're going to, you don't have a crystal ball to see how this is going to affect you emotionally, how this is going to affect you physically, how it's going to affect you financially. And yet you say, well, it's still what I signed up for. So whatever comes as a result of it, I've got to hold on to. And that's, I think, the biggest fallacy is that you take this stuff on. It's a weight that you never put down.
That phrase, well, it's what you signed up for, is used a lot, especially at the moment, because I'm trying to, you know, be one of the voices in moving the fire service to a healthy work week. It's a 42-hour work week, which would be a 24/72. And that's the pushback that some of these guys get. Oh, it's what you signed up for. And I couldn't disagree more. What you signed up for was to be a firefighter and or an EMT paramedic. The Northeast works 42 hours a week. The federal firefighters work 72. You know, some of the military and other ones, you know, a lot of ours are working 56 and then mandatory overtime. That's 80 plus hours a week. So that's not the job. That's the mismanagement of the department. So that's not right. What you signed up for.
That's right. Well, the implication is that you signed up for whatever they decide to put in front of you. And that's not true, right? Because that leaves it so open-ended and doesn't take into account the actual humanity. It just looks at the numbers and the bottom line.
Absolutely, which I'm learning now, it's a false economy. The numbers and the bottom line are horrendous because you've done it wrong. It's just that simple. Well, going back to kind of walking into law enforcement, let's talk about, you know, what was the mental health conversation, if any? And then what about kind of, you know, fitness standards, defensive tactics? What was that era that you found yourself entering?
Well, it was the mental health standard was non-existent. It was you can put stuff into your container, but you can't pour it out, right? Because emotions are weakness. That was steeped in that in the Midwest, right? Because like I said, men don't cry. You if anything makes the mistake of coming out, it's shamed right back into that container, right? And so that there was a dearth of that right off the bat. And then of course the physical standards, you had to be tough, you had to be strong, you had to be able to withstand, you know, all these terrible things. And then tactically, it was very competitive physically and tactically that's how you showed your worth. You didn't show your worth by being able to deal with anything sort of mentally healthily. You just had to, as long as you were tactically sound, as long as you were physically strong, then that was it. That's all you needed.
I heard you talking, I wish I could remember the podcast now. I think it was the Leo podcast? Dave is the host. I forget his last name. Anyway, and you were talking about being in, not corrections, I forget the term you use, but I remember that when in California,
in the custodial setting, yes.
Yeah. So is that, because right. I know it was LA and a lot of the other counties, you had to do kind of corrections first before you were put on the street. Is that the model that you entered?
Yes, because when I first started, it was with the Alameda County Sheriff's Department, and that was in the custodial setting. It was in North County Jail in Oakland. And at the time, I was like, okay, that's great. As long as at some point down the road, I'm going to get out on patrol, because that's really where I wanted to be. And I realized, so that's the reason that I went from Alameda County Sheriff's over to Hayward, is because I wanted to be out on the street, especially after 9/11, that I wanted to be the person that caught the next person to try to do that. Right. So I did all the anti-terrorism stuff, crime scene tech, vehicle inspection, anything I could do that was street level to be able to catch that. Cause I remember seeing a documentary that said that officers had pulled over the 9/11 hijackers, but because it was Department of Homeland Security time, where they basically didn't have all the information. All the agencies weren't talking with one another, and that one sort of got by on them. And then, so I was like, oh no, we can never let that happen again. And so I wanted to try to have all the knowledge in that particular thing.
What were some of the elements about the correction side that then served you well when you got on the street?
Well, it was definitely the situation where the rose-colored glasses came off pretty quick, right? Because I didn't have much exposure in any way up to that point, right? It's where I saw a lot of my firsts, right? I saw my first murder, dead body, the sexual assault, all this kind of stuff. And it was like my eyes become like, you know, like that, holy shit, but it can't be this. It's just got to be, you just got to keep the mask on, right? And so what that taught me was that you had to keep your guard up, because you never knew when somebody was going to basically be your friend in 1 second and try to, you know, punch you in the face or stab you in the back, literally stab you in the back the next second.
When you look back now at that, or if you look at our kind of corrections model at the moment, now with this kind of psychologist lens, king for a day, what would you do differently? And the reason I ask this, I've had people on the show, for example, prison governors from Norway, very, very different model, Bastoy, and their whole kind of ethos is let's take these men and women when they put them into communities. So it's a community of housing. They've lost their freedom. They're in prison, but they're on this island called Bastøy off Oslo. They cook, they clean, they go to school, they go to work. And so the whole point is that they are going to move in. I think it's 95% of all incarcerated, you know, men and women will move back into your street at some point. So let's make them, you know, let's rehabilitate them as much as we can. So their recidivism rate is the lowest in the world. When you look now, understanding just mental health in general and, you know, obviously this impact on violence and gang membership and some other things, King, for a day, what would you do, if anything at all, what would you change as far as our kind of, you know, correction system at the moment?
Well, that's a very good question, because back then the system was still ludicrously broken because the overpopulation and the staff being insufficient to be able to, it wasn't like there were programs in place. I would say that there needs to be definitely a more robust type of integration process, right? That the thing that they're doing now is they're basically just kind of throwing them all in there like cattle, and we can't be surprised when they do that, and then they end up creating communities of power inside the custodial setting where they're the powerful ones, where the people who are watching them or guarding them or whatever, they're not the highest on the food chain, right? And so they until we find a way to sufficiently reduce that population, it's going to be that way. And the problem is when I say sufficiently reduce that population, I'm not suggesting that we need to make it easier for people to get out. I'm saying that we are getting to a point now where it's so overpopulated and underguarded that all we can do is just basically try to survive from day to day. Well, they're better at surviving than we are at living in that and monitoring that system. So I would say, I mean, if there was any way that we could implement the system about which you spoke, yes, they do need, there does need to be more a type of community integration situation. But, you know, it's the problem with that is that if you, a lot of the people, what they're learning, or the things that they're learning inside of a custodial setting, aren't things that are translatable outside. They're basically just learning how to be better criminals inside, and then going outside and going, oh man, I can run the joint here because I'm better at survival than everybody I'm going to be living around, right? So I don't. If you want me to snap my fingers and make it better, I would say, can we move everybody over to that country and you know, or create a line that cycles through that so that they learn that. And it's, you know, it's ridiculous, I know, but the idea is that the system as a whole is broken and it needs to be changed 100%. Problem is there's not a one day fix of that. It would have to be integrated very slowly. And it just seems to be going, if we integrated slowly, we'd be able to do it. It would slowly get better. Problem is, it's slowly getting worse because more people are coming in. The regulation, you know, less people are guarding them, and all this kind of stuff. And so it's. I mean, there's a breaking point at some point. I'm just kind of sitting back waiting for it to happen.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And what was interesting is during COVID, how miserable people were being locked in their own apartments with their freedom somewhat. You know, but I mean, that shows. And what happened? Everyone divided. Do you want a mask? You're not a mask. Vaccine? No. You know, I mean, it was Crips and Bloods for influenza. It was insane.
Right.
But,
that's right.
But, you know, this is what's crazy is of course, it's not just the prisons. We have to go into the community. And I've said this, and this is my personal opinion, that the war on drugs, the prohibition is, 80 plus year longitudinal study that has shown to be an epic failure, because arresting addicts is not the solution. You look at other countries that do it, at Portugal and Switzerland, they've got the blueprint of how, you know, you, of course, you know, hunt down smugglers and dealers, but addicts, you put them through addiction counseling and job creation and, you know, mental health counseling and housing programs and get them on their feet. And now they're not draining taxes, they're earning taxes. So it's not just the prisons, but it has to be part of the conversation.
Well, they're dealing with the symptoms and the things that happens as a result of this brokenness. Instead of trying to deal from the top down, they're basically just dealing with the symptoms, trying to say, oh, we need to make it harsher, the penalties harsher. It's like, you can make the penalties harsher. It's just not going to do anything. It's not going to change it the way you think it's going to, because it's going to have to start, like I said, it's going to have to start from the, it's, and I hate to be cliche, but it's top down and inside out, not outside in. So.
Absolutely. Well, one more thing on the correction side, and then we'll progress to the street. But I think this, and again, I'm, you know, career firefighter, paramedic, so never been in law enforcement, certainly never been in corrections apart from to take patients out of them. What is, seems to be apparent to me is you've got these men and women that are incarcerated in these prisons and jails, but the guards are exposed to the same conditions. So they're working 12 hours. They've got sleep deprivation. They don't see daylight. So talk to me about the kind of impact of that job on you physically and mentally while you were doing that.
That was really tough, because the majority of the time, not only in custodial setting, but also in patrol, was spent on the midnight shift, which your body is not that it took a serious toll, really changed the just the interior of me, because having to, you know, wake up when the sun was going down and go to sleep when the sun was coming up, it you know, had the blackout curtains and kind of trying to trick your body into getting rest wasn't very good. Not to mention the fact that the majority of the time that you spend there in this sort of directorial type of setting, meaning you do this and you do this and you do this, and then you come home, you're exhausted, you're dealing with the people that love you, but then you're, you know, end up being the same sort of person that you are there at home. It doesn't work. It absolutely does not work. And it takes a toll, right? So there was definitely a lot of drinking, a lot of stuff like that, because the people listened to me more at work than they did at home. But then I realized when I realized that's, you know, I was trying to, you know, you've heard the term that when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was using a hammer and it wasn't working on the people that love me.
Yeah. Yeah. I know it's family, you know, wife, children don't take to you just barking commands too well.
Yeah. Do what I say. Go over here. Get in this room.
Well, then talk to me about the transition in the street. What was that first experience like? And then were there any specialty units that you joined?
So when we first went over, one of the things that sort of highlighted that I can look at with, you know, hindsight now, getting out on the street, I was like, okay, this is great. I was when I went through FTO, I struggled through FTO because there was always somebody right next to you that basically scrutinized your behavior, which I understand that. But it got a lot easier once I finally made the transition and started doing it on my own. It was the person. What I didn't realize at the time was obviously that person's specifically trying to poke to keep you, to get you ready for this type of thing, you know, get you ready for all the stressors of that. And there was no preparation for that. But one of the things that I realized, one of the very first, like I'm talking like right out of the gate, one of the very first, dead bodies that I had was there was one of the things, like I said, I kind of hindsight, there was four things in the 90s on that particular call. The temperature outside, the age of the lady, her weight before she absorbed all the stuff in the bathtub, and the thermostat that was turned up so she wouldn't be cold when she got out of the bathtub, right? And so when one of the things that I noticed is I didn't really have a template for it. And so when I saw this, it was shocking, but shocking. This is shocking. You know, this blank face is what shocked looked like, right? And so the thing that sort of stuck out to me in that particular situation is how I got a kudos for doing a good job in that particular setting, but I was shocked at how professionalism and shock looked like the same thing. Right. You know, as long as I maintain this facade, whatever boiling was going on in here was, you know, it was my problem to deal with. It wasn't anybody else's. It was like, if I had a problem with it, I needed to keep it to myself. Right. Which is that thing that gets drilled down into you. It's like, you can be shocked, just don't show it.
It was crazy as well, as you hear people that have been struggling, because when I started doing this, early on, I actually got a lot of phone calls from people originally, and ironically, most of them with a shaved head, covered in tattoos, big, you know, burly dudes, because again, you know, they have this mask, but then I have this mask and you have this mask. So we look at each other and we go, they're all fine. Why am I the only one being a pussy? Why is this bothering me when everyone else is okay? And then you climb inside one of the other people's heads and they're like, why is everyone else okay? Why am I only being a pussy? And you realize that everyone actually is going through, you know, obviously at certain degrees, depending on experience and the kind of, you know, the place that they are in their mind at that moment. But that mask, and I say this all the time, it absolutely has a place. You know, if you're going into a gunfight or we're going into a structure fire, you know, we can't be queening out and running around screaming, you know, we've got a job to do. But when you come out and you process the fact that the person in the efficiency that burnt to death and you had to drag out their body, that there you should have a human sadness, a reaction to that, you know, we just bury that down. So that mask is absolutely essential at times, but it's the yin and the yang. We've got to allow ourselves to have that empathy and compassion for ourselves as well.
Well, of course, you're serving a purpose because you're going to the worst situation in some people's lives. It's and for you, it's a Tuesday, right? But that implies that if you can't, you know, this mentality that we can't let it out here during this particular situation because we have a job to do, unfortunately bleeds over to the time where it's like, okay, time for you to deal with it. And you're like, no, I must be okay. Cause to show anything like that. Right. And the way I try to explain it to folks is like, you've seen the World's Strongest Man competition, right?
Oh yeah. Many times.
Obviously. Okay. Right. So biggest people in the world, strongest people in the world, lifting world records amounts of weight for world records amounts of times. When they finally put that weight down, does that mean that they're weak? Or does it mean it was just time to put it down? Right. And then I kind of switch over to, you know, you remember the first time you worked out, when you worked out, when you left, do you still today have a dumbbell like hanging around your waist from that workout? And it's like, no, of course not. Because you allowed yourself to put that weight down, leave, come back in and try again another day. Right. But with this type of stuff, you're like, as soon as I saw that thing and it melted me on the inside, and then I found out that nobody else was affected by it. And I just said, well, I guess I got to hold that weight forever then, because that's what I signed up for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. It's a great analogy, because if you pick the weight up and then give yourself ample rest and recovery, i.e. processing it, then you do develop resilience. You come back 100%. A little bit stronger if you sleep.
That's right.
All right. Well, then what about career calls as you progress through your time on the street? You know, what were some of the things that were memorable for you?
Oh, well, that first one, the thing I didn't tell you about that first one is that this little apartment that she was in, the coroner couldn't get the gurney back there. So they just brought the bag back and they set it, and she was in the bathtub, and she had, rigored up a little bit. And she, like I said, she was 90 pounds on her driver's license, but she had absorbed all the water. And so when they picked her up and put her in the bag, she went everywhere. Right. And everything came out. Like all, and I was, and in my mind, I'm like, and so the reason I highlight that particular one is because throughout the time that I was there, there were these oh shit moments where that are like sort of logos to each one of these things that happen. And so, you know, saw somebody get eaten by their dog. I saw, you know, lots of murders, some suicides that I'll never, you know, murder suicide I'll never be able to forget. There was a 19-year-old that ended up was an arranged marriage, and she hung herself with the scarf that her fiance had given her because he had broken up with her, and right, her life was over. And it's those images that are just sort of branded into your head, where I'm like, that you think, well, for somebody, for each one of those people, it was the most impactful, sending their life off in a trajectory. And for everybody that does the job, there's that. And then the next week there was this. And then the week after that, there was this. And there were some of the biggest, most impactful things were the ones where at the time I just sort of took a snapshot of it. And then it wasn't until after I looked back on it and through an emotional lens and went, oh my gosh, I can't believe that something like that happened. And then it's, so you have the moment that it happens, and then you have the sort of restamp of when you look at it through a different lens and go and try to think of the enormity of being the person in the situation to which that thing is happening. right? And so that can be that got to be kind of overwhelming because I didn't know how to deal with all that stuff. And like I said, I was drinking pretty heavily and not dealing with it really well. And of course, you know, trying to protect my family by telling them I'm fine and just sort of holding on to this myself, not realizing the whole time it was, you know, tearing a swath through me. So
had you already lost your mother by this point, or did that come during your time on the street?
That came in my time during the street. That was 20 years ago. It was 2004. And it was actually, about 4 years into being on the street, the two-year custodial setting, and then 4 years on the street. And so when my mom said she had cancer, we went through that whole process, and it was, you know, obviously it was the first time she told me she had cancer that was really impactful. And then it would go away and come back and go away and come back. And then come to find out that, you know, towards the end in 2004, that was sort of like, you need to get here. She's about to die. And I drive out from California out to Oklahoma, and the thing that I had a hard time sort of adjusting to is this idea, like, I'm a man, I'm this big tough cop, and I've been to all these terrible things. But the person that was sitting in the room at the time that happened wasn't the big tough cop. It was the 13-year-old who used to own this room that she's dying in, and sort of taking it in that way, but trying to just brush it off my shoulder like it's nothing. And it's like, well, wait a minute, this person's one of my best friends, and there's not a damn thing I can do about it, right? It was going from the person being outside having to sort of manage the chaos to being the person inside going, now what do I do? What the hell am I supposed to do with this, right? And I really struggled with that one because the summer, there's a story that I don't tell very often. I've written about it just because, you know, cathartically, you got to get it out. But the summer of that same year, I'm in a bad way. I'm in just in a real bad way. And I'm sitting up in my bedroom, just kind of contemplating the world, drinking, and just getting chewed up by it. And I'm sitting there staring out the window, drunk off my ass. And I look, and at the time, my 4-year-old son just happened to be walking by, and I'm like, "Hey, buddy, what's going on?" He comes in and kind of bebops in like it's nothing because, you know, he's 4 years old. The world hasn't happened to him yet. And I snatch him up like I'm kidnapping him practically. And I sit him down and I'm sitting there talking to him. And I'm telling him about this teddy bear that I had when I was a kid. And I go into this description about all the texture of the teddy bear, how much I miss it and all this kind of stuff. And I'm sure I'm just, you know, my slurred words are just coating the back of his neck. But I'm just... And I'm trying to like hold on to him literally and metaphorically, right? In this process. And finally he kind of wriggles out of my grasp and takes off, and I'm like, oh great. You know, in my head I'm thinking, oh, that's just another person, you know, that can't handle what it is that I'm trying to do, right? Really feeling sorry for myself. And I just kind of go back and staring out the window and drinking. A couple minutes later I look and he's standing at the door. And he's got his chin down like this, and he's standing at attention, and I notice he's got something behind his back, and he runs, and I was like, "Hey, buddy, what's going on?" He runs over to me, and he takes what's behind his back, pushes it right into my gut, and it was his teddy bear. And what I realized then was I was busted. I was really busted, and it took me a while. I felt so much shame for that. Nobody in the house deserved what was happening to them. I didn't think I deserved it either. Right. You know? And so, but I didn't know how to process it. Right. And so I felt even more sorry for myself, certainly shame for taking it out on them. Right. And then, but also really happy that he sort of recognized that I was struggling and wanted to try to help. He's 4 years old. Right. I mean, that's for him to do that was really cool. And I look back on that and still with a little bit of shame, but obviously, you know, very, very happy that he sort of absorbed that and was trying to help his dad. So
that really kind of reminds me of something that I say a lot now, but it reminds me of it because I've heard over and over and over again. And I just don't think that people hear this perspective. But when you think about 20 years ago, as you were talking about, you know, the rub some dirt in it generation, the way that suicide was discussed was it was cowardly, it was selfish. How could you think of the family? And then you hear, in my case, hundreds of people that have been right at that point. Some of them have gone through with their attempt, and thank God I'm able to talk to them because they survived. But over and over again, there's this reoccurring theme of burden and shame and guilt. And you That's don't right. hear that, you know, this. And I think that people don't understand, you talk about alcohol, if you take that perfect storm of unaddressed childhood trauma, sleep deprivation, the horrors that we see at work, alcohol, side effects of, you know, psych meds that people are taking them on, organizational stress and or betrayal, and you combine it, you know, then it becomes a perfect storm that literally miswires the brain and this reality shifts. And over again, I hear from these people who were absolutely at that point that they truly believed that they were the reason for their family's pain. And that at that moment made suicide courageous and selfless from a, right. you know, an occupation that decided they would die for a stranger. Of course, they're going to die for their loved ones. So talk to me about that. Where did that darkness take you? Because when you truly believe that you are the source of the family's pain, that reframes everything, even though through a healthy mind, it makes no sense.
Well, it's unfortunate, but I know what the barrel of my gun tastes like too. And I'm looking at this today. I don't even know how it didn't happen. Right. But having the perspective of that depth gave me a little insight. And I use a lot of analogy and metaphor to try to help people understand what's kind of happening. And from that comes this, you know, this sort of understanding. And one of the main things that I tell folks is that, first of all, I'm not a scientist, a scientific experiment perhaps, but not a scientist, right? I come from caveman stock. And so I'm trying to basically translate the thing that we go through to this sort of caveman mentality that is so that the person who is a caveman understands it, right? And so one of the things that I tell them, I go, this is your brain right here. This is your brain. This is my brain. This is everybody's brain. If you exist on this grain of sand that's hurtling through space right now, then this is your brain, right? If this is your brain, then that's that first little peanut that you get whenever you're first born, right? Fight, flight, faint, or freeze. For first responders, it's only one thing. It's fight, 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 or fight, right? And if you imagine this thing like a container, you get this container whenever you're born, and whether you have good parents, bad parents, no parents, love and support, abuse and neglect, or a laundry list of trauma from a whole entire career, it dictates how big that container is going to be and how often you're allowed to pour it out, right? Well, then you get older and you develop your higher functions, logic, reasoning, stuff like that, right? But tucked way deep into the core of this thing is fight, 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 or fight. That's that foundational stuff, right? Well, the reason that SWAT guys and military guys and everybody in this thing train over and over and over and over again is because whenever this thing turns on, all of this stuff turns off, right? If you've ever gotten really mad and done something stupid and then said, oh, why did I do that? I can't believe I did that. That's this portion of your brain casting judgment on this portion of your brain for doing the only thing it knows how to do, and that's react. It doesn't have eyeballs, doesn't have ears. It doesn't ruminate, contemplate, or investigate. It just reacts, right? The gator at the watering hole and about to get the zebra. You don't hear the zebra go, "Hey, let's talk about this," as they're running away. They're basically just reacting, right? And so in those moments where you think you're going to die or where you're getting into these high stress situations, this turns on and all of this turns off, right? And so the idea is the only goal whenever this thing is on is to turn it off, right? It's meant to find that spot where you're not feeling threatened, right? Well, if you're told your whole life that you're not allowed to feel that, to process any of the stuff inside this container, then it gets filled up to about 99% and goes off like this or stays on 24/7 and basically wears your ass out, right? So the idea is to remember that is your only goal is to find out, am I in this mindset where I'm like, fight, 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 defend, defend. And most people, you find that, you know, we try to make life decisions based from this mentality, and it does not work that way. Right. So the reason I say that is because, like I said before, I use a lot of analogy and metaphor. So I'm going to use one that I think will kind of help help you and hopefully other people understand what it means when you get to that point of desperation, what's happening, right? So have you ever been to like a county fair or anything like that?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So again, like I said, this applies to everybody, whether you're man, woman, however you identify, wherever it is you live, it doesn't matter. It applies to that thing you are before you're anything else. And that is a human being, that thing that we all are first, right? And then we get all this other stuff, right? Well, our humanity. So I'm telling you about the fair. What do you think of whenever you think of the fair?
The Ferris wheel. The first thing.
Ferris wheel, funnel case, corn dogs, stuff like that. The games, all this kind of stuff, right? Well, have you ever remember the game where the horses are racing each other, and it's like a water gun, but you're in that lane. It's like the Kentucky Derby type thing.
Absolutely.
Okay, so imagine that every human being on the planet has four horses. Then those four horses are the team responsible for pulling your life, right? You, me, everybody. Everybody who's listening. Okay. There's the physical horse. That's the container that you came in, right? That's whether you're tall or short or wide or thin or you're sick all the time or a gym bro. It's the spectrum on which everybody falls somewhere, right? Then there's the intellectual horse, book smart versus street smart, somewhere in between, a little bit of both. Social horse, right? Loner, cool kid in the group, somewhere in between, a little bit of both. Then there's the emotional horse, okay? Bang, the gun goes off, your life starts, and again, it starts in childhood, so there's things that happen in childhood, right? For me, speaking specifically from myself, we go, the horses take off, the team takes off to try to figure out who you are. You're going to be the athlete, you're going to be the brainiac, you're going to be the party animal, a little bit of both, right? Nobody wants to be the emotional one, especially, and I know that was, you know, emotions are weakness, so why would I let this one come out? We're going to tuck this one back behind the gate. We're going to weld the gate shut. And when things get difficult, here's how we're going to handle it. We're going to either fight. We're going to work out. We're going to work overtime. We're going to intellectualize, right? How many guys you know that can solve everybody else's problems but their own, right?
Absolutely. And the overtime as well. Overtime is just to jump in on that. The number of people that don't identify working as filling that void as a coping mechanism, because 100%. They're deliberately choosing to be away from the very thing that was most important to them, which is their family.
Right. And they know that, but they're too afraid to deal with this portion of what they need to deal with. Right. Because if you're told your whole entire life, you're not allowed to deal with it, then you got to lean into the other parts. Right. Socially, what do? We go and we hang out with our pals and we drink and we talk about the things that have happened in the day. And the worst part about this one is, you know, the choir practice, you go and you talk with your pals and you say, hey, you know, that was a pretty crazy call we just went to that was where the kid death was. And then they're like, and you look at them and they're like, eh, whatever, right? Because they're having the same problem you are. They don't want to deal with it. They don't want to show anything. They're keeping that facade up. And then you look and see their reaction and go, well, that boiling in my gut must just be the problem that I have. Right. It's not that this thing is a normal reaction by a normal person. Right. But what you don't realize is that all this, there's stuff being stacked up in this lane. It's just being stacked up. Right. It's like a Mount Everest pile of shit of all the terrible things you're seeing and all the ways you don't want to deal with it and all this kind of stuff. And what you don't realize is that these three end up becoming just jacked. They are yoked from their use. And they're like, if things get tough on this, how I'm going to deal with it. And this one, on the other hand, is like a doe-eyed baby walking on stilts that doesn't ever want to come out. Cause the idea of dealing with that, and these three are bullies, right? Cause if this one ever comes out, there's that feeling in your gut, that shame that goes, how dare you? You can't come out. We'll take care of this. If I want to deal with something, they're trying to deal with it intellectually. They're like, yes, I know. I understand that I need help and I need to do this, but they're not actually processing anything, right? Because this horse right here is basically saying, don't come out. I don't want you to come out. I'll understand it for you, right? You just stay back over there. Well, eventually that Mount Everest pile of crap, something happens, whether it gets something cannonballs into that pile or it's a piece of paper, doesn't matter. If the container's full, it rolls down, kicks that gate open, and this doe-eyed baby comes out, looks at this pile of stuff and goes, I can't deal with this, too much. I can't even hold up my own weight, much less the weight of everything I've ignored up to this point, right? And so if you think about it like that, it makes sense why some of these guys are taking their life, because they're like, this isn't working. And when I let this one out through a gauntlet of shame and guilt, and through everybody else I'm thinking is judging me about dealing with this, this Mount Everest pile of crap, you go, well, obviously the only option is for me to take my own life, because I can't handle what I'm dealing with.
Absolutely. I think that's the thing with this, you know, the shame, the guilt, and obviously the sense of burdensome, is you don't really hear that discussed. And I would argue that, you know, one of the things that needs to be front and center, one of the biggest red flags, whether you see it within yourself or you hear it through one of your, you know, loved ones or coworkers or whatever it is, you know, if you truly start believing that you are the issue, that you are the problem, that's a massive sign to go get help. Because that's, I think, is where there's that switch. And I've talked about this a lot. We had an absolutely horrendous case in Florida. I think it was like 6 or 8 months ago now. A couple, both law enforcement officers, both young, and they just had a little boy or a little girl. I forget which gender it was. The husband takes his own life, takes his own life. And about 7 days later, the girlfriend does. So now this infant is left on its own. Healthy mind goes, what were they thinking? It's so selfish. How could you?
Sure.
But at that moment, clearly, there was this absolute miswiring and this shift where they must have believed that this little child they just brought into the world, you know, that child was worthy to have someone better than themselves.
Yeah,
so they were
better off without us. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think that needs to be front and center as well.
Well, the thing is, too, that they make that assessment from here, and everybody that views that assessment is made from here. And they go, well, how could they possibly have done that? It's like, well, if you get into this mindset, things like that are illogical, make a lot more sense.
Absolutely. Well, what about your journey? You talked about, you know, having tasted the taste of the barrel. That obviously, I'm assuming, along with that moment with your little boy and then sitting there, you know, holding your mother's hand when she passed, which I did with my grandfather with cancer. You know, all these elements, you're in these deep kind of pits now. How do you start getting yourself out? And what does that toolbox start to look like that works for you, Don, specifically?
Well, so it took a while, because my relationship was really suffering. And my wife can, or my ex now can attest to the struggles that I went through and the ways that I wasn't sort of dealing with it. The part that was probably the toughest was the fact that anybody in my life, I think they would just be too afraid to sort of confront me about it and say, hey, you're changing as a person. You're right. Because then it would sort of highlight the fact that I'm this busted person. But it took getting injured to basically really push me down into a hole, right? Because that's when I was more suicidal, because being in the job was one thing, but then being on the front lines and then having this injury, it swallowed me up, because I had no idea, you know, at the time it felt like everybody sort of abandoned me. Right. And so getting the injury and having a couple surgeries and then, you know, taking pills and getting addicted to pills and doing that and alcohol at the same time, it got really bad. And that's, like I said, that's the time when I actually was thinking about ending it all. And actually, thankfully, it was the deeply seated idea that killing yourself was a sin, right? Because I was raised Southern Baptist in the Midwest, and that's, you know, that's a everybody but us was going to hell type of mentality. But that was there was a deep sense of guilt if I had done that and the people I'd be sort of leaving behind. And so the only reason I didn't was because of that thing that was drilled down pretty deeply. But when I went out on that particular injury, it was very isolating, and I couldn't understand why the majority of the people that I'd worked with, nobody would contact me, find out how I'm doing, stuff like that, and it made a real profound sense of bitterness that I had a hard time dealing with, because I couldn't figure out why somebody wouldn't, you know, they weren't support their brother and this family. And I'm going to air quote the hell out of that, because what I realized, and a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine who didn't abandon me, helped me understand that a little bit better whenever he said, imagine you're on the front lines of a war and you're in the trenches, right? You and something happens and you get injured and you get taken off the front line. It's not because the people at the front line don't want to do that. They're still in the war trying to deal with that particular situation. And what I also realized additionally is that I was having to deal with this portion. I was having to deal with the emotional portion of it. And I was disappointed that the people with whom I worked didn't have the capacity to deal with, right? So I know that there's some people that kind of said, I don't want to go over there and deal with that, because I know it's just going to be him telling me how bad everything is and how much he's struggling and stuff like that. And if you imagine these are like muscles, right? I'm trying to make this stronger when I feel really weak, and then asking other people who've never even let their horse out to say, hey, help me deal with this. And when they kind of turn their back on me, it felt like a betrayal, right? And I really had a hard time dealing with that betrayal, right? It wasn't until after I got all the way out of the job that deal with that bitterness of that and sort of get that separation that I realized how ingrained that mentality actually was. And so when I finally decided to actually become a therapist, it was sort of like, well, I got to deal with my own shit first, because that stuff's, what I would be doing if I just became a therapist and didn't deal with it is intellectualizing everything and completely avoiding all the stuff that I needed to deal with by myself. And it was a real, real struggle, because like I said, if these things are muscles, you're basically asking to put weight on this thing when all three of these are really strong, and you can't. You want to rely on these things to try to deal with your struggles, and to deal with the stuff emotionally was it had to go through this idea that I wasn't allowed to, that there was something wrong with me, or like all those the stigma mentality of those hurdles trying to cross into that area to say, well, what if I'm not broken? What if this thing that I'm having is a normal human being reacting normally to these extraordinary circumstances? And I had to use that what if scenario to go, oh yeah, I guess I am a human being. You know, I mean, the strongest people in the world, you can be the strongest people in the world, doesn't negate the fact that there's an emotional component that everybody has, that you can avoid it if you want. You can live your whole life without avoiding it. But you can't be surprised that when you go to put weight on it, that it's not there to pick it up if you've never used it.
Absolutely. The mental health impact of an injury, I think, is another thing that's under discussed. And I just had a friend of mine who's a firefighter and an athlete, and he tore a bicep and he just kind of hit a wall. And you know, he was kind of like, you know, frustrated and confused about it. I'm like, dude, I've heard this so many times. And I had a back injury that took me out for 6 months. And, you know, it is, you've got that organizational betrayal where there's, you know, for example, leaders in that genuinely are just not, you know, uncaring about the welfare of their people. But even the brothers and sisters that you have in uniform, I agree completely. Some, you know, may not care as much as they should, but others are simply, I mean, they're in the meat grinder. You know, a lot of them don't have the capacity to think. And even the people that we lose, a lot of the widows say to me, look, everyone was there the first week and then no one was there. You know, and this is the point. So I think as a side note, getting people to actually be assigned to check in, because, you know, again, it's that feeling of organizational betrayal, this tribe that you said, I will die for these men and women in uniform. And the moment you get hurt, they're nowhere to be found. And I hear this over and over and over again. And I don't think most of it is from malice. I mean, the more, you know, strained we become with this recruitment crisis, I would argue the lower amount of camaraderie we're forging, because, you know, you should have a high bar and shared suffering and, you know, a sense of achievement after probationary year that you've earned that spot. And I think that forges people together. But I mean, I've had great stories. My first department hire, Leah, one of their guys, I think he got hit on a road accident while they were working it, and was really badly hurt, and they re-roofed his house while he was in hospital and surprised him. The next department I went for,
Very similar incident. Another guy got hit on the road, and I forget what happened with his house, but they completely redid his house and he came out of hospital. That is the brotherhood and sisterhood. But I feel like, yeah, you know, we kind of forget that. Yes, you know, my back was injured. And yes, it was horrendous not being a firefighter, you know, and losing that identity and tribe and purpose. But it's losing the people, you know, it's feeling like you completely disregarded and forgotten. That's truly detrimental. It's not the pain. It's not the surgery. It's that emotional piece.
That's 100% right. Yeah. That I didn't want to admit that I had a problem at the time. Of course, I still don't want to admit that I had a problem, but I had a problem. And whether I want, and so having the stigma of it, but then also not being honest with it myself, you know, it's going to create this distorted reality of what's really going on.
Absolutely. So you talked about it being a struggle. You know, you transition into the mental health space. Obviously, you want to be part of the solution. And I think lived experience is a big part of that. So what were the tools then that you started finding work for you? Because I think this is another, you know, irresponsible thing that happens with some organizations, like, oh, EMDR is a fix-all for everything, or this therapy. And what I'm learning now is yours might be psychedelics, talk therapy, and equine therapy, or it might be canines and, you know, a military retreat and something else. So what did you start realizing worked for you? And then that's transition into you actually becoming the mental health professional.
Well, obviously staying physically active as an outlet was pretty important. And then going to therapy myself. The thing I found most difficult about going to therapy myself was that, so when I was the police officer before, did the whole anti-terrorism thing, and one of the things that they taught us was how to read people's facial expressions and body language for basically whenever somebody's telling a lie, right? So as a therapist now, I tell you, you know, you can lie all you want, you're just not doing it to me, right? And so the thing is that I had a hard time with was being able to find somebody that, number one, could take the stories, because there wasn't like there was some that I was going, hey, I want to find a therapist who was a former first responder. It's like, there's nobody out there. There was nobody out there, especially at the time. And if there were, they were either hundreds of miles away or didn't have any availability whatsoever because their schedule was so full, right? And so being able to find that outlet was difficult because I could talk with somebody for a little bit, tell them a couple stories, and then realize that I'm melting their brain with some of the content that I have, pulling back and then trying again with somebody else and pulling back and trying again with somebody else. I found that I was very much in the infancy of a person doing what I was doing, meaning first responder / therapist, and trying to find somebody that I felt like actually listened, that I could actually listen and take what I was doing, because I was so scrutinizing with my own vulnerable part of myself that being able to talk with somebody and then see when they sort of gave up or checked out, and knowing it before they even were willing to admit it, was like, well, this is kind of tough because I still have this stuff back here that I need to tell somebody about. But it's almost becomes careless at saying, okay, I've got this story where, you know, you find the 3-year-old in the freezer, and this story where you find where the lady gets eaten by her dog. And I can go through all this stuff just ba-bang, ba-bang, ba-bang. And I started doing EMDR, which did help a lot. But more than anything else, I found that on any given day, there's going to need to be something, whatever the thing is that helps you sort of process this in a healthy way. Like you said, there's so many things out there now that are available to be able to deal with this, but there's not a one size fits all type of situation, because some of the things I found that worked only because of the person that was delivering it, right? It's like, I need to be able to believe the person that I'm talking with is helping me deal with it, as opposed to going EMDR. Well, EMDR with this person is going to be different than EMDR with this person. And the first time I did EMDR, I didn't feel like it was very effective, because I didn't think that the person was kind of phoning it in, right? And so I became very scrutinizing, much like every other first responder out there, in the genuineness of the person with whom I'm, and that was really what it was about, is just being able to find the person that genuinely wanted to be there to help, and knowing that they're the person that wanted to be there to help, and just sort of being content with not dumping it all on one person, right? And finding and sort of just kind of letting out a little bit along the way, and it just, it got better and better as it went along. Do I still deal with stuff? Of course I do. I'm a human being just like everybody else.
Well, you touched on, I think this is an important point as well. I've heard a lot of EAP horror stories, you know, counselors being sent, responders being sent to the wrong person. And what really is sad is those are the ones I've heard. How many have we not heard? Because that was the final nail in the coffin. I went to see someone, they started crying, or they told me to get out, you know, and so I must be completely broken. I'm just going to go, you know, that's the extra bit of burden and shame that they needed to get to that point. So talk to me about that for a second. You know, now as we sit here in 2024, how does someone listening online, because obviously people are, you know, listening from all over the world, how do they find, you know, or increase the likelihood of finding the right fit of counselor, so they're not having to go through 6-8 people, you know, to find someone who actually can, you know, is culturally competent?
Well, that's one of the main parts of this message that I'm trying to say, is that we feel this sense of obligation. And I remember some of the first therapists that I went to feeling this idea, like, I, once I started talking with them, whether I liked them or not, I had to stay with them, or I had to engage in this process. And I was like, I didn't get a good, you know, you can kind of get a good vibe, and, you know, first responders are pretty good with that initial vibe. And so finding somebody that, being able to actually engage with somebody, make that initial assessment, find out whether they're going to be the person. And then honestly, and it's really tough to have the courage to go, you're not the person for me, right? Because you feel like it's personal. It feels like you're sort of insulting them. You're not trying to insult them, but you're also unfamiliar with the process. And taking that initial sense of vulnerability and not interpreting it as you're the reason that it's not working or why it's not coming out. So that's, you make these extrapolations that if I go into this person and they recoil in horror, then it's my fault, right? It's sort of like, nah, you just haven't found the right person yet. And that's kind of the whole idea of this mission that I talk about, right? Is sort of being able to sort of stand up for yourself and talk and find, when you first connect with somebody, if they're not the person for you, they're not the person for you. I don't take that stuff personally, because I realize that we're all kind of working on a different level and from different arenas. And so just being able to sort of start out the process with the right glasses, right? That's ultimately what it comes down to, is because if you have a bad taste in your mouth for what therapy is and how it's going to help you and stuff like that, then you can have the best GPS in the world, but if you start in the wrong place, you're going to end up in the wrong place. And so ultimately you're trying to go, what do I need to find at the very beginning? What's the thing that I need? Well, a lot of people don't have any clue what they need. And so what they need initially is to be able to go, do I feel okay with the person with whom I'm speaking? Do I feel like they're, am I able to make this personal assessment from the inside out, that when I give them the most vulnerable part of myself, that I'll be okay? Because that's really what it's about. You just don't want it. You don't want to take this thing that's like you've been protecting your whole life, put it out there, and then have somebody go, ugh, right? Or have somebody laugh and point, right? Because it's that vulnerable, that thing that you don't even want to admit, that vulnerability that you got to kind of put out there. And being able to put that out there and go, well, I'm making this assessment about the person with whom I'm about to tell the most deepest, darkest parts of myself. Will I be okay afterward? Well, it's like, you don't have a crystal ball, but you do have the ability to sort of emotionally say, do I get along with this person enough? Do I feel like if I let this stuff out, this person will care for that thing that's going to come out and not wound me even further? Because I've noticed a lot of folks that come into my practice, they've been to other places, they've had that sort of, yeah, I had a bad taste in my mouth from this previous experience, and now I got to the point that's so desperate that I reached out to you, and I kind of lay, part of being able to do it is laying out the truth for them, letting them know that this isn't an easy process, that you're going to have to, that it's going to feel uncomfortable, that you're going to not be good at it, and sort of explain to you that, explain to them that idea that there's different parts of yourself trying to basically protect you. Intellectually, you can come into a therapy session and go, yes, I understand exactly what you're saying, and I can, and I know I need to do this. And you walk through this, this robotic process. But then I go, well, yes, that's, you're right. You do understand it intellectually. But what you're going to have to sort of prepare for is this idea that it's going to feel uncomfortable, that you're going to be doing things against what this, this system that's been in place to try to protect you. That doesn't work anymore. That you gotta put some weight on this other stuff. And you, I find that if you prepare in advance with this message, that it it allows them to kind of start from the right place. That's really my my whole thing. This whole mission, as it were, is making sure that you start from the right place, right? And the mission, as I'm, I obviously play on words, is. You got to acknowledge that something's going on, right? If you've been depressed for 20 years, it's not who you are. You've been depressed for 20 years, right? So you got to have to acknowledge that. You have to accept the level to which that thing is negatively affecting your life, right? I only drink a little bit. Everybody else thinks you're an alcoholic, right? Until it changes in you, it ain't going to change. And this is the mission right here. You got to give yourself permission to act on your own behalf. It's going to be really uncomfortable. I'm going to tell you, this is going to be really uncomfortable. You're going to be putting weight on a muscle that hasn't been exercised, and the other three bully horses are basically going to be telling you, you're such a pussy. You got to get that thing back and get back in the gate. Right. And you have to acknowledge that it's still got to, you still got to exercise that muscle. You got to lean into the idea that, hey, I thought I was going to die. Hey, that thing I saw really hurt me. And I couldn't understand what it was I was seeing. Right. You basically, part of it is just understanding that when you start accepting that there was fear, that means that you're a human being, right? There's going to be fear. I thought I was going to die, or I thought I saw something in my own family that I saw on this call, and being able to sort of absorb this idea that, and I didn't have any control over it, right? We're supposed to have this control that extends into these situations. And when I have these things that goes outside of my control, it's like, oops, that went against that system I said was never going to happen. And it did. Right. And so you're kind of confronting this idea that you had control over that whole thing. Right. One of the main things I talk with folks about is the ABCs, right? A is the event, right? Whatever the chronological event is, and first responders have hundreds of them, if not thousands. B is the oh shit moment, and then C is the value statement or the unanswered question. You know, why would God do this, right? And so the example I use is I had a conversation with somebody, pulled somebody over for a traffic stop. Nothing, no issue with the person with whom they pulled it over. They go to write them a ticket. Come back in their car, they're writing the ticket, they've got their foot sitting outside the door, the door's open, and it's on the freeway, and he's writing his ticket, and then he looks up in his rearview mirror and he realizes that there's a car bearing on him going about 90 miles an hour. It's about to obliterate him, right? And it did. It messed him up, and he got all tore up. He was physically injured. Went through this big, huge rehabilitation process, and then comes out on the other side, and then for some reason when he gets back to work, he can't re-engage. And so the highlight that I make there, obviously his oh shit moment is that snapshot he took looking into the rearview mirror, realizing that that thing was about to hit him and there wasn't a damn thing he could do about it, right? Because he had this concrete structure that believed that he'd always be able to do something about it, no matter what. Even if it was a flinch in the right direction to kind of dive out of the way, he'd be able, but he didn't, right? And so it shattered this thing he thought was going to be there forever. And what I tell the folks that I come in contact with is when that stuff happens, you got to admit that it happened and that you were afraid and that it goes against this structure that you've had built and that you have to rebuild it based on the fact that that thing had actually happened, right? I talked a fair amount of folks who believed that they were literally going to die. Like they've had, you know, like combat vets and stuff like that. And they have this idea that they're that you know, they have these moments, these oh shit moments where they think they're going to die, right? Well, we can't be surprised after somebody gets that snapshot moment afterwards where they start being a little bit more impulsive and a little bit more careless because they think they're playing on the house's money, right? They think, well, I was supposed to die back there, right? And so you got to be able to talk about how afraid you were. Well, I wasn't afraid. Yes, you were. You are, if you're a human being, you were afraid. You have to admit that you're afraid and that you didn't have any control over it, or, and all this kind of stuff, right? And it's that just being able to get to that point where you admit that stuff kind of allows you to go, yes, I was afraid. And you need to let yourself feel the full fear rather than that truncated version that you felt at the time that was forced out, right? And just kind of go, yeah, I thought I was going to die. And it's like, okay, yeah, that's what normal human beings feel when somebody's shooting at them. Or when you have these things that happen that are so severe, they're like flashbangs, right? They're so big and you don't have any control over it. And when you have a mentality that basically says you got to be in control of everything and you've got to handle the situation and when that stuff happens, it goes against those internal rules we tell ourselves we're going to abide by forever, right?
Absolutely. Well, I want to hit one more area and then we'll go to some closing questions. You also have got quite a lot of specialties when it comes to, you know, family unit, marriage, on that side as well. So talk to me about the nuances of that, because, I mean, a lot of these conversations when it comes to mental health, we're talking about the individual. Let's expand now to the family dynamic.
Well, so what I noticed, or at least the flaws and the mistakes that I made, was that communication is the biggest thing that you can do. And when I say communication, I'm not talking about how you walk in the front door and you sit your family down and say, hey, I just had this terrible thing happen and here's the details, right? Because I'm fine is not communication, right? And in this family structure, you have to realize that from the moment you start doing any type of first responder work, it's going to change you as a person. That is guaranteed, right? You can be the healthiest person in the world. You can be the most emotionally healthy person, and it's still going to change you because you're seeing some terrible things and you're exposed to a lot of high emotion stuff that you don't have control over, right? And so being able to sort of communicate that and say, like, take for example, you come home after a really bad call. The last thing you want to do is tell everybody that you're fine, right? Because if you imagine, well, let's take my son at 4 years old, right? If I had had these terrible things happen and I walk in, you know, daddy loves you and he gives you a hug and all this kind of stuff. And the first language that kids learn is body language. There's no question. You can see this far in front of your face. The kid's absorbing everything that you're doing, right? And you come in and you're just coated with tension and all this stuff that you're not processing. And then you come in and your kid says, hey, daddy, what's wrong? And you go, oh, I'm fine. He's getting this mixed message about, you're basically telling everybody that fine is this version that you're seeing and it's not fine, right? You got to be able to actually say, I had something very significant happen today. It was very impactful. I'm still trying to process that thing. And just being honest with sort of opening up and saying, I had this terrible thing happen. I'm still trying to understand it. I need to go and talk to somebody about it. But including them in that communication to say that these things have happened, not the details of, you're not trying to vicariously traumatize anybody. You're basically just trying to say, I had this thing happen. It's a weight that I'm carrying, but the weight doesn't have anything to do with you, right? I want you to know that I care enough about you to tell you that this thing happened, but also to let you know that if I start to, you're trying to create a communication dialogue that allows you to tell them that an event happened, but obviously not the details of the event, but also that this event that happened may sort of affect me in a way that when you see something, it won't be your fault, right? Because especially kids think, well, if you tell me you're fine and then I still feel uncomfortable, then it must be my fault, right? And that's a terrible message to tell them. You just want to be able to go, I had this thing happen to me. I'm still trying to process it. I'm still trying to work on it, but I want you to know that I love you. I care for you. And that all this stuff that you, this tension that you feel from me is not, you're not responsible for. And you got to be as open as you can about being able to tell somebody like that, because in the absence of having an explanation, people will take it upon themselves to say, well, it must be that something that I'm doing. It's built into us, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Beautiful. Well, I want to go to some closing questions. Going to be mindful of your time. The first one I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
I don't know if you know Paul Gilmartin's book, if you've seen that one.
I've heard of him. Yeah. What's the name of it?
That I think is, I want to say, oh my gosh, I can't remember. It's a red and white book, Emotional Support for
Law Enforcement.
Yeah. And it's a very simple text, meaning it's not super long and not very complicated, but it does give a good sort of snapshot of what to expect and how when you have these, you know, traumatizing events on the daily, recognizing the red flags. And so, you know, you can be the smartest person in the world and recognize all the red flags, but you still have to be able to get to the start line to deal with it, right? Giving yourself permission to deal with it. But just knowing that it's going on and making sure that knowledge is showing you that it's this thing that you thought was a mystery isn't a mystery. It's a reaction, right? You get a cut on your arm, you feel pain. Pain tells your brain that something's wrong with your arm, right? Your arm didn't do anything wrong, right? But if you're starting to feel anxiety and depression and anger and stuff like that, and it's coming out in your world in places that it's not normally wouldn't normally, but also are not supposed to, then that's the back part of your brain telling the front part of your brain that something's wrong, not something's wrong with you, right? And addressing that system that says that when this thing happens, it's a symptom of the thing that's happened to you, not a symptom of the disease that you have. Right. But Gilmartin's book would be one I'd definitely recommend.
Brilliant. What about documentaries and or films?
Ooh, well, so there's one particular film that when I saw it, it kind of like made me, it like really plucked the string was End of Watch. And that one was a real tough one to watch towards the end, especially at the time I was still kind of trying to deal with stuff. I would say it's a pretty good look into it, but it's also be cautious because if you're still dealing with PTSD, that's not the thing that you want to necessarily watch. You know what? Actually, that's a really good question. I wish I'd come more prepared and being able to answer that question.
Yeah, no, one film is great. Right. Well, the next question, before we talk about, you know, where people can find you and obviously your services, what do you do to decompress these days?
Again, staying active. I do. Recently, I've done a lot of I went to a place called Elevate out of Boise, and I went to this. It's really good, by the way. And they had all these, you know, float services and red light therapy and detoxifying, like physically detoxifying thing. And I find that stuff to be really, really helpful. I am actually actively looking for a therapist to kind of to catch this phase of what it is I'm trying to do. And so my recommendation more than anything else is to be mindful of the old mindsets of, you know, making sure that I'm not getting into the same sort of cycles that allow me to hold on to too much weight. Because I'll be the first one to tell you, like I said, I'm a human being like everybody else. I feel stress. I feel anxiety. And sometimes that stuff gets to be a lot too much. But staying physically active, staying like finding when I'm not, you know, getting into social settings that might otherwise make me, you know, sometimes I, you know, people want to be isolated and they just want to kind of fall back and recoup. And you're not recouping when you're by yourself. It's one of those things you gotta stay active because you need to be able, one of the main things I think that I do is making sure I'm staying plugged in with other people to say, hey, you know, what's going on with you? You're using them as a good barometer and making sure that I'm trying to stay connected to this idea that when somebody gives me that feedback, they're doing it for me and not to me. Right.
Absolutely. All right. Well, then where can people find you online and obviously the website for your services?
Well, so if you'll find me on Psychology Today, it's Don with two N's, Bradley, and it's out of Brentwood, out of the Northern California Brentwood, not the OJ Brentwood. And on, honestly, I don't market a lot. I do it because this message I'm trying to do, if it were up to me, you know, I'd do the little Men in Black pin thing and block out my face. Cause honestly, I'm just trying to get folks out there. I don't really market that much, but I will tell everybody that's listening here, if you're struggling and you're having a hard time, by all means, reach out. You can call me, email me, therapywithdon@gmail.com. And just, you know, like I said, I don't want anybody to get to the depth of the places that I've gotten to, or the ones that I've seeing the stories on. It's like, before you go, let's talk, right? Because basically I don't want anybody to have to carry that weight. So, like I said, I'm not necessarily trying to market myself. I just want to get the message out there that to give yourself permission to kind of step into this. But if you need help with that, then by all means, therapywithdon@gmail.com or look on Psychology Today and you'll find me.
Beautiful. Yeah, I don't think you need to market. I think the lack of counselors is outweighed by the immense need from the first responder community. So you're an invaluable resource. So I want to thank you so much, not only for obviously talking about, you know, the psychological side, but also, again, you know, your own courageous vulnerability in telling your story, because I think that lived experience and that vulnerability is truly, you know, what joins someone with that therapist. They don't have to have this traumatic life, but as you said, if they're intellect, if they're purely academic, then there's that disconnect and that can be very dangerous. So I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thanks for having me, James. I appreciate you.